Hello, welcome once again to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us this week. It is episode 8 of our Disney bracket, meaning that we are halfway through round 1. This week, we'll be discussing Peter Pan versus 2000's Dinosaur.
So, before we get into it, in Peter Pan, part of flying is thinking of the happiest thought. So, what is your happiest thought? What would make you fly if you had access to pixie dust?
Not having student loans anymore.
Depressingly millennial of you, but yes, you're not wrong.
It's only fair for me to ask the same of you.
Wendy has the whole, like, I'm thinking of a mermaid lagoon thing and I'm into that. Like, just like a nice quiet cove with water and maybe some conversation, but they're all screaming because they're mermaids and they're above water, so they scream. Ah. Let's get into summaries. So, in Peter Pan, there's an altercation in the nursery, and 12-year-old Wendy Darling's father tells her that tomorrow she must move out of the nursery and start to grow up, before storming off to a fancy dinner party. The hero of Wendy's fairy tales, Peter Pan, shows up in her bedroom and asks her to be his mother and tell him stories. Entranced by the idea of never growing up, Wendy flies off to the Neverland of her make-believes. Neverland proves to be a trash place. The pirates try to kill her. The Lost Boys try to kill her. The mermaids try to kill her. The people living to the north of the island make her fetch firewood while everyone else parties. Eventually, she tells the boys it's high time they all went home. That night, while they sleep, Captain Hook, having tricked Pan's fairy into telling him where they're hiding, captures them all and prepares to make them walk the plank. Peter Pan saves them, drives the pirates off, commandeers their ship. He returns Wendy and her brothers home. Her parents get home around the same time, and they reconcile. Roll credits.
Millions of years earlier, through a Rube Goldbergian series of events, an iguanodon egg is separated from its nest and deposited on a small island inhabited only by lemurs. One of the lemurs, Pleo, decides to adopt the baby dinosaur despite her father Yar's protests, and names the baby Aladar. A few years later, Aladar is an adult and helping Yar and Pleo prepare the young lemurs for their mating ritual. Shortly thereafter, meteorites fall, everyone, other than the named characters, die. Aladar carries the survivors to the mainland. After running from predators, the group stumbles upon a multi-species herd traveling towards the nesting grounds, and joins them. Aladar and the lemurs befriend an old lesbian couple, Baleen and Ema, and their dog. They're having trouble keeping up with the rest of the herd. Aladar goes to speak to the leader, Crone, but is rebuked by Crone, saying only the strong survive. Aladar helps the elders keep pace, and shows up Crone by digging for water in a dry lake bed, saving the herd from dehydration, and impressing Crone's sister, Neera. Crone repays this by moving on without Aladar's group the next morning. Traveling forward, they come across Bruton, Crone's second, who has been injured while scouting. They invite him to take refuge in a cave with them that night. In the cave, they're attacked by Carnotaurs. Bruton sacrifices himself to cause a cave-in, killing one of the predators and allowing the others to escape further into the cave. They discover the cave exits into the nesting ground, and that the route Crone's herd took is blocked. Aladar goes back to warn the herd and lead them through the caves. Crone fights to maintain leadership, but loses and refuses to join the others. Now alone, the remaining Carnotaur attacks. Neera and Aladar defend Crone, and he dies. Neera and Aladar have babies in the nesting grounds. Roll credits.
Before we do anything else, I want to talk about how Bruton is perhaps the most obviously named Disney character. He's the brute of the group. What's his name? Bruton. God bless this movie.
There's quite a bit to say about Dinosaur, but let's go ahead and dive into Peter Pan first.
And before we do, as usual, the race stuff is a lot. We're going to try to not get into it too much. We have stuff posted on the Facebook about that. It's worse than I remembered.
It's very bad. It's probably the worst that we've seen so far in the bracket. There's a lot of problems with this movie.
I want to say a few goods before we get there. There's some good animation, Wendy has a nose, and there's some pretty good music.
Some of the standout animation things that I noticed, the cloth wrinkles in the bedroom and on the clothing are outstanding. The way they animate those is really fluid, and it feels very natural.
Also, shout out to whatever intern at Walt Disney had to animate every single one of the little fairy sparkles for Tinkerbell.
In general, all the effects with Tinkerbell and the pixie dust are pretty good. Another really great aspect of the animation is the fight scenes between Pan and Hook. they draw really heavily from the sort of swashbuckling adventure movies that were really popular at the time. Think Errol Flynn. Exactly the sort of thing that I was wishing they would have done last week, they did here. And it's great. I love it.
Peter Pan's ability to fly, combined with the unlimited creativity that an animated landscape affords you, means they can do some fun creative stuff that you might not see anywhere else.
If I had to describe it, it's somewhere in between swashbuckling adventure and Looney Tunes.
Yeah. Like, there's that great moment where Pan and Hook are fencing and they go off a cliff and Pan can fly so he doesn't mind, then Hook notices and falls.
Another thing that I love about this movie is just the character of Hook himself. He is wonderfully over the top. He wears his faults on his sleeve and is also devilishly evil.
Captain Hook is one of the most fun roles for anybody to play. I can't think of many Captain Hooks who aren't delightfully hammy and over the top, and this is definitely a good example of that, especially since they have the unlimited space of animation to let him bounce all over the set and throw things at Smee with abandon.
But they also still give him these calculating plans, like everything that he does with kidnapping Tiger Lily and manipulating Tinkerbell into figuring out where Peter's base is. A lot of scenes with Hook just getting to go all out are great. I'm struggling to find other good things to say.
This is less a compliment for the movie, but for the story of Peter Pan. I get why it's enduringly good, because it's basically Westworld for 12-year-olds.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, because you have all these things that are not real. They are a hyper-realized version of them. The pirates are the idea of pirates. They don't actually do any piracy. They just sort of sit there in the cove wearing pirate outfits and being on a pirate ship and singing
she sells by the seashore.
And singing songs one associates with the sea. The mermaids are both utterly beautiful and utterly murderous. The people who live on the north end of the island are an amalgam of various American indigenous societies. You have all these things that are caricatures because these are the fantasies of a 12-year-old girl who's never really left her house, as opposed to an accurate reflection of the universe, and her working through how the real world is actually much scarier than her fantasies made it out to be is a good story. That's a really interesting coming-of-age tale, and it makes sense that her fantasies would be these caricatures. It's just unfortunate that those caricatures are also super racially insensitive in some cases. If they swap that out with, like, Romans or cowboys, you could have avoided a lot of that.
Although I do think that how it's written and the way they went through the theater reinforces the colonialist perspective that Wendy obviously would have growing up in a upper-class English home.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely true to period. It's just also that when you realize these are all Wendy's conjurations, it makes Wendy kind of a shitlord. And I feel bad about saying that a 12-year-old girl is a shitlord, but...
I think she got her fair share of shit put on her in this film, so I'll call that a wash. Since we're going to start digging into the bad, where do we want to start?
Let's hit up the gender stuff. That's gonna be fun.
The gender stuff is the less obvious stuff, so...
There's this weird thing where Wendy is virginal and chaste compared to every other woman we meet who are all kind of lustful, sexualized.
I definitely think we have the whole Madonna whore dichotomy going on. You're in one camp or the other.
Oh, throwing that out there. There is a literary term, the virgin whore complex. We know that the better term is sex worker, but in this context, we're going to use that.
It's a literary term. We're using the term here because of its literary trope connections as opposed to attempting to denigrate sex work.
It's less obvious with, say, Tiger Lily. She's still a child, so they don't over-sexualize her too much, but she definitely is more forward in her affections for Peter Pan. And then you have the mermaids who just don't have clothes.
The mermaids don't have clothes, yet one of them chastises Wendy for showing up in a nightdress. The mermaid who says it is not wearing a bra. There's a lot of really shitty gender role things going on here. You have Tinkerbell, who is sexualized throughout the entire film. She's in this short dress. You can see what she's wearing under that dress.
She has some body image issues based on a shot of her looking at her hips in the mirror and being disgruntled, and that's never really addressed. It's just sort of there.
And then they play it for laughs when her hips get stuck in the keyhole of the drawer. Man, yeah. She gets spanked a lot for pixie dust.
Which is canon to the book, so thanks, Barry.
In general, Tink is just there to be a sexy antagonistic lamp.
She saves Peter at the end, and that's pretty cool. I appreciate her realizing, oh, I've betrayed Peter, I should go save him. That's fair enough. But after she explodes and their house falls in on her and Peter coaxes her back to life, there's not really any resolution to that. There's nothing where Peter seems to reevaluate his relationship with Tink, or where Tink does the same with Peter, or where he realizes that how he approaches people as objects is shitty.
Not even necessarily objects, but means to an end. Everyone has their purpose for Peter. People don't just exist because they exist.
Which is definitely in line with his character in the books. His character in the books is far more sinister, and he's incredibly solipsistic. It's mentioned that he doesn't like the Lost Boys growing up, so he thins the herd whenever they get too old.
Peter doesn't treat anyone with respect unless they are providing him with something, whether that is a mother figure, someone to fight against, or praise and respect him. He does not care.
It comes so close to having a coherent arc with that, because Wendy becomes thoroughly disillusioned with Neverland and Peter Pan as a person, and that's what prompts her decision to go home. And it's so close to having that be a good learning experience about why you shouldn't idolize boys who don't grow up. But then the third act comes in, and Wendy just says, oh no, Peter will save us, and he does, and that arc is ephemerized. The opening sequence in the nursery, before we get to any of the fantastical stuff, where it's just the children and Nana the dog and their father being aghast at the whole thing, is really funny. It's delightful slapstick, and their dad, who's played by the same voice actor as Captain Hook, also gets to do all these fun bellowing roars about, oh, these children!
Pirate, absolute poppycock!
Although it does reinforce how shitty the Darling parents are. Mr. Darling gets upset because the boys take his cufflinks for buried treasure and use... I'm not even sure what that article of clothing is. Some sort of, like...
Shirt front.
Yeah, it's...
Cummerbund. We'll just call it cummerbund. It's a fun word.
Uses some sort of Victorian article of clothing as a treasure map. And he doesn't get upset with them... He gets upset with Wendy for filling their heads with these ideas. And so she punishes Wendy for what they did by saying,
dear
Mary, the child's growing up. It's high time she had a room of her own.
Probably the least effective punishment for a tween girl ever, giving her her own room.
I get that you have to grow up is a scary thing to tell a kid. I think the devil in the details trips things up a bit.
It gets even worse because it's very apparent that Mr. and Mrs. Darling are not the ones who are taking care of their children. It falls to Wendy as the oldest daughter, or Nana, the dog.
Who is an incredibly competent nurse, and I have nothing bad to say about Nana.
No, Nana's great. Nana deserves so much better. This movie has a lot of crappy things to say about gender, and it's so hypocritical because towards the end of the film, it tries to have the Lost Boys, before they're about to walk the plank, think of and respect their mothers. And it's so hypocritical considering how poorly you've treated almost every female character in this film up until this point.
And to be fair, none of them were mothers, but you kind of have, again, this like Madonna whore complex thing where Madonnas can be mothers and that's okay, but otherwise, if a woman isn't a mother, then she's a lesser being.
So... while Hook is attempting to manipulate Tink into finding out where Peter is, he is talking about their relationship and how disposable he sees that Peter thinks Tinkerbell is. And he uses the term like an old glove.
Casting her aside like an old glove.
Like, if you're familiar with the term no glove, no love, popular safe sex marketing term in, like, the 80s, 90s. Glove does have the connotation of condom. Now, I'm not sure exactly when the euphemism started common use, but that again feeds into this dichotomy where women can be useful as mothers or useful as sex objects, and there's no in between, and if they're not useful for either, then there's no point of them being there.
The thing where Tinkerbell immediately decides Wendy is a threat and can't reconcile that in any way beyond trying to get the Lost Boys to kill her is frustrating. I would have loved to see a version of this where Tinkerbell and Wendy bond over anything. They both have feelings for the same person and are both incredibly spirited people. It would have been really cool to see something come of that.
Even if it's just them sort of bonding over them realizing that Peter's kind of shit. So I think we've about covered the problems of gender in this film. Let's go and tackle the other really problematic thing in this film.
The way Peter Pan literally plays panpipes?
Not what I was thinking, but go on.
It's actually not a problem to me. I kind of like it. There's a really great podcast that I'll link in part of the episode description that explores Pan, the deity slash mythic figure, and how a revival of interest in Pan as a myth at the time that Peter Pan was being written influenced Pan as a literary character, and how that unbroken connection and this yearning for an unspoiled nature definitely plays into elements of the story. Also, it references Lovecraft, and I know that y'all love that Lovecrafty stuff.
Speaking of Lovecraft, let's talk about this movie's blatant racism.
Oh God, I was trying to stave it off.
Let's talk about the more minor bit. So when we first get to Neverland, we see Captain Hook poring over a map of the island, trying to figure out where Peter's base is located. He's crossing off it's not at Mermaid Lagoon, it's not at the Indian Village, and it's not at Cannibal Cove. I'm glad we never get to see Cannibal Cove, because the picture associated with that location is a heavily caricaturized idea of a African tribesman with a spear and a shield and a leopard print skirt. And I am not sure if they intended to go there at some point, but cut it from the film, or whether even they realized that that was a bad idea.
But luckily, we never see that.
But again, I am gonna ding at the points because there's that blatantly racist caricature on the map and associated with cannibals, which during the time of writing the original novel was expected in pulp literature. So I guess adhering to the source material, but this was made in 1953, only 11 years before the Civil Rights Act.
It's a long 11 years from this movie. Moving on to the Indian Village, as it's the nicest way that it's described. They have this very pan-Indian vibe. When John is tracking them with their feet, he's like, ah, yes, they're Algonquin, which you can tell from feet, apparently, which are Great Lakes region. Their dress and housing is far more plains, but they also have totem poles, which are primarily a Pacific Northwest thing.
And there's also the various slurs that are used in the film, including a musical number.
And a lot of those scenes are added in. Those aren't really in the books. There's a Saving Tiger Lily thing, and then in thanks, they guard Peter Pan's hideout for a bit. It was Disney's choice to take us up to the village and explore indigenous history.
There is no way to salvage any of this without massive rewrites. It's just bad. So, one of our favorite adaptions of this story is actually Hook, with Dustin Hoffman and
Robin Williams.
It's a great film, and they just ignore this whole area for their narrative, and it's just pirates versus Lost Boys.
And that's fine.
And also, both of those groups are very multicultural. You get to see a young Dante Bosco as Rufio. Most of you will probably recognize him as the voice of Zuko from Avatar The Last Airbender.
And that is a far better dichotomy because it frames the narrative as a conflict between children and adults, or arguably children and man-children, but whatever. And that dichotomy works because all the pirates are portrayed as being very childish. Like, they're not mature people for the most part. I like the idea that this is a place for people who don't want to grow up. And with the Lost Boys and the pirates, that makes perfect sense. They don't want to deal with adulthood and modernity and taxes and stocks and bonds and stuff. When you bring in cultures that are real in incarnations that they existed in the past, it erases the time and change and atrocities that have happened in the real world where people didn't have the choice to grow up. They were forced to.
I think we've hit all the heavy stuff that we need to.
Anything else we want to hit while we're here?
A few minor pedantic things. Because Hook is a man of his word and he promises Tinkerbell that he won't lay a finger on Pan, he decides to take care of him via a time bomb disguised as a gift from Wendy with a little note. And I think this is probably the least believable part of this film. There is no way in my mind that Peter Pan would have taken the time to learn how to read.
Although I like the time bomb change. In the book and in most adaptions, Hook tries to poison Peter with either like a cake or pouring something in his water or whatever. Changing that from a poison to a literal clock being the thing that almost kills Peter is a really good reinforcement of this idea of time being the thing that he tries to escape, especially since you have Hook fleeing the crocodile with the timepiece in its belly. Thematically it works, but yeah, it doesn't make any dang sense that he can read. Let's jump over to Dinosaur.
Yes.
Let me say that properly. Let's jump over to Dinosaur.
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 I think we've gotten that out of the way for now. So, good things we can say about Dinosaur. The animation holds up reasonably well. So this came out 5 years after Toy Story, which, if you take a look at the leap there, is pretty significant. It's actually pretty impressive. It's definitely a little hokey by modern standards, but it's not unbearable to watch.
It helps that most of the things they're animating are dinosaurs, which are both things that we don't see in the real world and do not have fur or feathers. Reptiles don't have as much complicated things to render. A thing that I think is actually really impressive with the dinosaurs is they often have this weight to them. The plodding of feet and the way that dinosaurs will slam into each other and they feel like they're actually hitting something. It's like these models have actual mass, and that's really impressive. When you look at the lemurs, they're a little rougher because they have mammalian skin and fur, and it doesn't look quite as good. Thankfully, the lemurs aren't in the narrative too much.
Another thing that helps is a lot of the backgrounds are not CG rendered, but they're just B-roll of various wilderness areas. It works for the most part. There's a few times where it definitely just looks like the model is pasted into this background, but they do a pretty decent job of hiding it. The CG is pretty good. It was actually done by one of the many companies that Disney has bought and then very soon after shuttered.
Casting her aside!
Because they weren't willing to make the investment on what it costs to have a decent visual effects animation studio. So this is the Secret Lab. They had done various films throughout the mid 80s and 90s, and in, I believe, 1998, they were acquired by Walt Disney Corporation and set up as their visual effects studio that was supposedly going to rival Pixar. And by 2002, 2 years after this film was made, they were shuttered. Although their work here is a lot better than Image Movers Digital was with Christmas Carol. So I feel a little bit more bad for the Secret Lab.
Yeah, I don't hate looking at the things in this one.
One thing I will say for the animation, there are a few scenes that have the unnecessary slow motion thing going on. Yeah. It doesn't really add anything. The animation isn't quite good enough to necessitate it. It's not a big thing, but it's an annoyance.
Speaking of animation, can we talk about how weirdly sexy Neera is? I get it, she's the love interest, but they do an uncomfortably good job evoking the idea of the sexy, curvaceous lady with a dinosaur.
Yeah, it all comes down to curves. Neera is much more curvaceous compared to the other iguanodons in the film. Kron and Bruton especially are incredibly angular. They have these sort of horny plates on their heads and necks. Aladar is a bit softer, but he's supposed to be our handsome pretty boy leading man, so it works.
Speaking of Kron, can we talk about how in any other movie he would be something in the military? Everything about him just screams, like, general.
The film isn't necessarily subtle about its themes of helping community as opposed to individualism, which they're good themes. I like them. They're a little heavy-handed, but it's a kid's movie.
Going in, I didn't realize we're going to get a pretty solid castigation of ranting objectivism from dinosaurs, but we did. And honestly, it's kind of the movie I needed right just then. It kind of, it gave me joy. Aldar is sort of blisteringly sincere with his collectivism over individualism. We're kind of sleeping on Aldar as dateable Disney lead.
Speaking of dateable...
Oh gods, I shouldn't have given you that lead-in.
In this film, there's a lemur named Zini, who is Aldar's de facto best friend. He has the same voice actor as Daxter from the Jack and Daxter series. And it's basically the same character, except more annoying. There's literally a line where he says, "It looks like you need some help from the love monkey."
Yeah, give us a better impression. Come on.
Sounds like you need some help from the love monkey.
The love monkey.
Yeah, I died.
Thankfully, most of the lemurs are not very important to the plot. But one thing I do have to ask, where does Zini get all of his hair gel?
There's also, like, weird fungus things that have medicinal properties that conveniently grow in caves where you hide out when you're injured. I think there's just a lot of unusual herbology happening in the Cretaceous-Jurassic period.
Let's not get into all the biology things can't happen because those dinosaurs lived millions of years apart stuff.
Although, they did, of course, go for the most obvious dinosaur choices. You get a unassuming four-legged thing with a relatively short neck to be our protagonist. Then you get a long neck, something akin to Triceratops, and that's about it.
And then the T-Rexes are the bad guys.
Yep, that's how...
Except here they're Carnotaurs.
Carnotaurs. That said, I do love our long neck and Triceratops couple. They're not technically a couple, but it's Pride Month, so everything's gayer now.
Also, the film is not subtle with the subtext. Like, they very much read as these old ladies who found each other and are in lesbians with each other.
They're the best part of the film.
Oh yeah, Baleen and Ema are great.
Baleen is this incredibly old British lady, whereas Ema is incredibly sarcastic and it bounces off with Baleen really well. There's a bit where Bruton has been injured, they find him on the road.
We can't just leave him here.
We can if we move fast enough.
I'm sad that my two favorite dinosaurs didn't get lines. There's an Ankylosaurus, who's a dog, and then there's some Pachycephalosaurs, who just aren't in the background.
It's also weird that the Ankylosaurus-type dinosaur is a dog. It's just weird that, oh, these dinosaurs get to be humanized and have talking lines, but no, you get to be a dog.
I get it when it's the predators and the herbivores that don't have a common language. That's a pretty common trope for things, but it is weird that that one dinosaur is just not. I'm wondering if he was originally supposed to be more of a wisecrack guy, but then they realized they didn't need Enki and Zini as wisecrackers.
Also, in contrast to Peter Pan, this film has a scene that pretty much calls out catcalling as bad, don't do it, which I love.
It's a little on the nose. Everything in this movie is a little on the nose. But
I believe you mean on the snout.
Yeah, I do mean on the snout. That's a good line. Heck off. Because this movie has a pretty even gender distribution, we do pass a Bechdel test, which is pretty cool.
Although there's odd stuff with gender going on, with older brother Kron kind of being the sexual gatekeeper to his younger sister.
I'm not sure if it's meant to be read in a sexual way, but there's some vibes there.
I mean, it's not just you. I have written down in my notes, "No one mates with my sister but me." That's not a line, but that's definitely the vibe I got from Kron in a few instances.
I'm wondering if there is a plan for him to be like a father or a husband or whatever, and that got switched kind of late into production and then no one fixed that. Because he definitely also reads as noticeably older.
There's some odd stuff going on with that relationship.
Because he's a bad guy, it doesn't bother me that he's also a very toxic masculine figure. I like the idea that you can only get to the nesting grounds once you get rid of the toxicity in your herd.
I do kind of also like Bruton's redemption arc.
Yeah.
It's small, it's pretty subtle, but he goes from being Kron's second in command, who is even more gung-ho about competition makes a healthier market,
Libertarianism is good, actually.
Then he goes off to scout, is injured, and then Kron kicks him to the curb. It's like, no, you're weak, you're going to slow us down, and you probably led the Predators here already. Then he's shown kindness by Aladar and his troop, and he eventually sacrifices his life so the others can escape.
It's a solid redemption. That's exactly how you do it.
Well, there's quite a bit plot-wise that actually goes on in this film. There does seem to be quite a bit of padding with these sort of spectacle montages throughout the film. And I get it, like, this movie was definitely supposed to be spectacle. This was supposed to be 2000's version of James Cameron's Avatar. But looking back, almost 20 years later, they are just kind of there.
While I'm a fan of the Rube Goldberg... You say it.
Rube Goldbergian.
Thank you. Stuff at the beginning that gets the egg to the island with the lemurs is fun. We get some cool spectacle of different dinosaur species in different places and all that jazz. It doesn't really do anything. We don't need this. You could have started with Aladar already an adult on the island, or at least hatching on the island, and cut out a good 5 or 7 minutes of your movie and put that somewhere more character driven.
Although, fun fact, most of the reason that beginning scene is in there is because the whole film was supposed to be like it. Originally, the idea behind the film was to have the super realistic dinosaurs placed in these B-roll shot nature footage without any dialogue to tell a story. Disney decided not to go with that route, and I get it, they're working on making a children's film, and I don't think you can sell kids on just an hour and a half of dinosaurs doing things, maybe some fights, but absolutely no dialogue.
I definitely watch that, but I think you couldn't have the fun of Billy and Nima, and you wouldn't have the explorations of collectivism versus individualism.
Mm-hmm. I think the direction that they moved in works. But it is kind of interesting to see that little bit of holdovers from a previous direction for the project.
I also do want to praise the music in this. I mean, there aren't songs. This doesn't need to be musical. I can't imagine any franchise where the dinosaurs sing doing well.
Except Land Before Time.
That's the joke. If you explain the joke, there is no joke.
I mean, we were going to talk about Land Before Time anyway, specifically because this pretty much hits the exact middle ground between Jurassic Park and the Land Before Time series, which were both hugely popular throughout the 90s. And Disney wanted that dinosaur money and wanted to bring those audiences together. I think they mostly succeeded. I didn't have too many problems with the film. It's not fantastic, but it's a solid film. The plot's a little heavy-handed, but it works. I don't think it's slow.
And it's a kid's film. I mean, I'm okay with heavy-handed plots there.
The animation looks good for being 18 years old. I don't have a lot of bad things to say about this. It may be that I wasn't being critical enough because we watched this after Peter Pan.
But I mean, I think it's also just a pretty solid film. It's a pretty solid B. It doesn't really push the envelope as much as it could, but it is a very solid thing.
I think we've kind of tipped our hand already, but let's go ahead and make our final decision this week.
Yeah, it's Dinosaur.
Dinosaur, hands down. I understand why people like Peter Pan, although if you haven't seen it in a while, you're probably remembering a lot through nostalgia goggles, and I would probably take a second look. It's super problematic.
Or alternatively, watch, say, Peter Pan that came out in 2003, or watch Hook, or listen to the proposed sequel, Hook 2, which is linked in the description of this episode. There's a lot of Peter Pan-related things you could watch that aren't this, that might give you some of that same feeling of whimsy without the stuff that will make you feel sad. What's up next week?
Next week, episode 9, starting on the right-hand side of our bracket, we have 101 Dalmatians versus Emperor's New Groove.
We both feel very strongly about one of these films, and it's not the same film, so that's going to be fun to navigate through.
Once again, thank you for listening to us rant about Disney films.
If you like what we have to say, share it with your friends, follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Follow us on Podbean to stay up to date with all of our episodes. We are pretty consistent about updating on Fridays.
Yeah.
But that's it for this week. We hope to see you again soon.